Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. Episode 43 is about what we do know about software engineering. It follows on from episode 42, in which I talked about what I don't know about software. Typically, things in the realm of product design and marketing, and also embedding sort of security thinking into the product development lifecycle, even though, you know, I at one point knew enough about security practice to write a textbook on it. I don't have that as sort of a regular tool in my toolbox at the moment. And so I mentioned that I'd written Appropriate Behavior, the things programmers need to know that aren't programming. And even in the course of writing that episode and producing that episode, I realized that there was a section on information security that was completely missing from Appropriate Behavior. I've since identified three sections, InfoSec being one of them, performance analysis and optimization being the second, and software engineering research and how to use it being the third. And then while I was writing that list in preparation for this episode of the podcast, I realized that I don't talk about databases at all in Appropriate Behavior. So there's probably way more sections. There's probably way more that a programmer needs to know that isn't programming. There's way more that software engineers need to know about software engineering. And so this led me to think, what is the process? How do we systematize knowledge of software engineering? And firstly, we have to kind of scope that question. Now, we know that the answer isn't the IEEE's software engineering body of knowledge, because we know that the ACM withdrew from the effort of producing that when they realized that that body of knowledge wasn't going to cover safety critical software and its production. So we know that a body of knowledge is not complete. Whatever our idea of completeness is, we can identify a gap. So let's think about a different thing. Let's think about Knuth's The Art of Computer Programming. Now, this is a book that evidently isn't complete. For a start, Knuth is still writing it. He has described future volumes, at least 5, 6, and 7. Maybe there are 9 volumes, I don't remember. But what we have at the moment are volumes 1 to 4a, the MMIX supplement, which goes back to volume 1 and rewrites the programming language that it's in, so that future algorithms can be written in this new programming language that wouldn't be convenient or possible, but probably just convenient to write in the original MIX language. And then we have some fascicles to volume 4. We don't yet have volume 4b. We don't yet have volumes 5 and above. But computer science is a vastly moving target, and there is a lot that goes into it. It's, you know, the theoretical study of information and algorithms. And in fact, I would say The Art of Computer Programming is really an algorithms zoo. It is a monograph on the topic of what we know about algorithms and selection of algorithms for particular purposes. It is not even a guide to the body of computer science knowledge. But there are two different types of knowledge, I think, that would go into the Art of Software Engineering book. You know, if you imagined doing the same thing that Knuth did, but for software engineering, we would have two different kinds of knowledge. And in fact, I'm going to present two different variations on two different kinds of knowledge. On the one hand, we would have fact knowledge and opinion knowledge. So, you know, the things that we actually know about software engineering, and then the things that everybody knows about software engineering that, you know, maybe there isn't actually any basis for, actually maybe, like, if you scratch under the surface, you find that these are things we have decided about software engineering. You know, a very simple example of this is test-driven development. And in fact, this, like, highlights the conflict between the, like, fact knowledge and the opinion knowledge. So there's the Bob Martin approach to TDD, which is to say the jury is in, TDD works, get over it. Like, so you should be doing TDD. Why? Because Bob Martin says so. Why does Bob Martin say so? Because TDD works. Then you've got Greg Wilson saying there is so much evidence that TDD doesn't work that until he sees something very compelling, he's just going to assume that TDD doesn't work and ignore the subject completely. So, what is the difference between these two people? Well, Bob Martin is a software engineer, a programmer, a mentor, a consultant, a trainer. He is someone who makes software and helps others to make software. And his experience, his sort of expert opinion, expert advice, if you like, on how to build software is use TDD. Greg Wilson is an empirical software engineer, or at least he's someone who uses the tool set of empirical software engineering. I think he's actually a commercial programmer now. Anyway, he is someone who looks at the literature, at the, like, scholarly literature, at academic studies of test-driven development, and says time and time again, and he points to six papers on his blog. I will link to the sixth of those where he summarizes this idea that the six of them together and each individually demonstrate no benefit to test-driven development. So is this fact knowledge and opinion knowledge, or is it like systematic knowledge and folkloric knowledge? Is it stuff that we have studied and come to a conclusion to, or is it stuff that we have agreed collectively through the telling of stories to each other and the sharing of experiences? Because both of these make significant contributions to the field of software engineering, and both have significant contributions to make. Because we can't resolve that conflict without further investigation. So we need to accept that both of these things are true at the same time, even though they are conflicting. So we see these six studies on TDD, these academic studies that have, you know, certain approaches to methodology, to rigor, to replicability, and so on, and say, okay, we accept that none of these show positive results to TDD. Well, what are they looking at? You know, perhaps, and this is quite common in empirical software engineering, they're looking at something to do with the outcome, with the software that you write, or to the process of writing the software, or maybe the time it takes, or the numbers of, like, goes round, you know, redos you have to try before you get to a working solution. And it's saying that there's no evidence in favour of TDD in terms of those outcomes. Or maybe that's compatible with what Bob Martin means by TDD works, get over it. Maybe he's saying this yields working software the same as not doing it does, but I feel more confident in the fact that my software works at the end. Therefore, that's my preferred way of working, and, you know, I believe it should be your preferred way of working too. That argument is not one that I am saying is correct. It is one that I am saying is consistent with these apparently conflicting outcomes. So both outcomes could be true. One could be saying the software that you get by applying TDD is no better than the software you get by not doing it. And one could be saying the process of software engineering is better when you do TDD than it is when you don't do it. And both of these things can be correct. And both of these things tell us something useful about the process of software engineering and the outcomes of software engineering. So we need a art of software engineering that takes both of these sources of information. Both of these approaches to evidence gathering and opinion forming in software engineering into account, and synthesizes a view that is compatible with both. Now, next question, for whom? Because software engineering is actually a, if you think about like a manufactory, like car working, you don't have car makers, car testers, car deployers, but you do have people who make wheels, people who make engines, people who assemble engines together, people who assemble cars together, people who make glass for windows and windscreens and things. We have a division of labour. The same is true in software engineering. Now, is software engineering actually the appropriate umbrella for a collection of activities? Or is it computing? Is it informatics? What is the broad collection of people who are involved in the software construction activities, and what subset from anywhere from like one particular occupation to the entire endeavor should this art of software engineering be produced for? It's often the case that we conflate the terms programmer and software engineer, and particularly with the sort of slightly more informal, in the software engineering sense, phrase engineer. A programmer and an engineer would be the same role in an organization. Tester and QA would be the same role, even though those mean different things, as do programmer and engineer. I want to be a bit more specific and a bit more precise here. I want to say that yes, a programmer is a software engineer. Not all software engineers are programmers. Someone who is a QA, who is part of a software engineering effort, who is taking an engineering approach to software in their QA work, is a software engineer. And same goes for not only testers, but like penetration testers, agile coaches, sysadmins, database administrators, business analysts, software architects. All of these are software engineering roles. They are all divisions of the labour of engineering software. Do they all get something from the art of software engineering? If there were to be some massive, like, multi-volume textbook, you could go wham onto someone's desk and go, here's everything that we know about software engineering. Would all of those people get something out of it, or would it be targeted towards a particular role? And is it likely, and this is a rhetorical question now because the answer is yes, but is it likely that that targeted role is more likely to be a programmer than any of the other roles in software engineering? So Knuth has a problem with the art of computer programming, that it's basically forever out of date. He is spending, I don't know how much effort he's spending on these relative tasks, but like what he's producing is kind of looking back and updating previous sections, or replacing previous sections, or augmenting them at one rate, and is producing new sections at another rate. There may be a Red Queen effect where he is running to stand still, or he might actually be running at full tilt and still moving backwards. The whole field might be advancing much faster than he is. Would that situation arise in software engineering? If you tried to be the Donald Knuth of software engineering and write that multi-volume textbook, would an individual be able to do it? Would it be only achievable if you took a more sort of encyclopedic approach and had multiple contributors who each took different sections and wrote them? Well, obviously, if we are able to divide the pie in non-conflicting, non-overlapping ways, then it would be faster to give it to multiple people, just because, again, division of labour. But also, the old Brooks Law thing, there isn't actually a load of communication required to synchronise on this project, given that I told you that each of these sections is isolated, distinct, non-conflicting, non-overlapping. We can just say, okay, you get to write the section on build systems, and Here's the table of contents. Anything you need to refer to, use a reference from the table of contents. If it doesn't exist, add one yourself, and then let us know when you're done. We'll update the table of contents, and then someone else can take any of the other sections that we now find are still needed. But actually, I think that this probably is a one-person task. I think it would be easier to complete the Art of Software Engineering and stay up to date with it than it is for Nuth to complete the Art of Computer Programming and stay up to date with it. Now, why is that? It's because I don't think that ideas in software engineering go out of date as fast as many people assume if you're thinking at the correct level of abstraction. Now, a lot of people say you've got to always be learning, there's always new technologies, you can't stay up to date in software engineering. It is true that you cannot stay up to date with the technologies, but the ideas, it certainly is possible, I think, for one person to keep the ideas in their head and then to fit new technologies into those ideas. The people who are saying, oh, you've always got to be learning, there's always something new, are looking at maybe the web ecosystem, where there are always new libraries, new frameworks, but actually the overall paradigm hasn't changed in 30 years or so. The HTTP as this stateless application level transport has been modified to add encryption with TLS, compression, session keeper lives. HTTP 2 and HTTP 3 add small but important ideas to HTTP 1. It has been extended with distributed authoring and versioning, which is a 1990s technology, with publish and subscribe, with WebSockets. Those things, and then there's the server client architecture, where you have your sort of back-end application running on a server, which then generates HTML, and the innovations on top of that are CSS and JavaScript. Many others have come and gone, but those ones have been around for multiple decades and now seem to be pretty much de facto standards, along with RSS perhaps. That separation, that architecture has remained the same, and all that these frameworks are doing is giving you different ways to generate the HTML, CSS and JavaScript, and to respond to browser events, and to coordinate the back end and the front end. If you understand the three-tiered architecture, you kind of understand microservices. If you understand three-tiered architecture, you understand both web objects and Rails, or Rails and single page applications, for that matter, progressive web applications. There's ideas in there that are actually decades old and fairly static, but there's implementations in there that change very frequently. If you are a new developer, then you are trying to keep up with ideas and technology at the same time. And so the fact that the technology is changing so rapidly gives you the impression that the field is changing rapidly. If you are able to sort of abstract yourself away from the individual technologies and just look at how the ideas are evolving, that is much slower. We could look at particular sort of vendors outside of the web ecosystem. We could say that if you're in the Microsoft world, then technology is changing fairly rapidly, in that there's been the native Windows Win32 type ecosystem, then the .NET sort of ecosystem, and then the UWP, and then whatever it is it's called now that includes Android and all of that stuff. But actually that's only four changes or three changes in four decades. So that's one change a decade. And again, those are technological changes. The difference between a .NET application, a UWP application, and a Win32 application is like the libraries and the compiler tools that you use, they are all like rich applications that run on a client. They all embody the same idea. They all have the same or very similar user interfaces. So anything that you've learned about HI design, about Fitts' law, about human-computer interaction, applies to all of them equally. So these ideas are very slow changing. The technologies are faster changing. And in fact, maybe the ideas aren't changing. They're just coming in and out of fashion. You know, there isn't really a theoretical underpinning to software engineering. So we can't say that there was an advance. We can't say that, structured programming is newer than functional programming, because functional programming was embodied in Lisp in the 50s and structured programming was only invented by Dijkstra in the 60s. Therefore, functional programming is old hat and structured programming is new, because structured programming has since gone out of fashion and functional programming has come back into fashion. We can't say that object-oriented programming is better than structured programming. It's just different, and you know, it has its own sort of cycles of trends that go at different rates. You know, so commercial developers in many fields have typically standardized on OOP thinking, but startup programmers often talk more about functional programming, but scientific programmers are more or less using structured programming, depending on the science domain, and seeing object-oriented programming as a methodology for organizing and packaging those sorts of structures. And so for them, it is a novelty to come into, again, as I say, depending on the actual field of science you're looking at. So very hard to say that any of these things is old hat or out of date, just that they're not currently in fashion. They may well come round again. Computer-aided software engineering was a massive fashion in the 80s and the 90s. This was like rapid application development. People still do rapid application development. They still use those tools. They may say that they're doing agile, but they're using ideas from RAD, and they're using tools from RAD like Interface Builder, which is still a thing, or Delphi, which has a different name now, but is still a thing. Visual Studio Expression Blend, XAML, these are all RAD-style application builders. So I think I've mentioned before on the podcast an idea called SEMAT, Software Engineering Methods and Tools. That is the explicit acknowledgement that there is no underlying theory of software engineering, and replacing it with two things. One is a systems approach. So you just say, what kind of outcomes are we getting? What kind of outcomes do we want? Which of the things that we are doing most influence those outcomes? Which of the things that we are doing will be influenced by changing those things? Or which of the other things that we are doing will influence how we are doing those things? Now, what can we change in order to adapt our actual outcomes to more closely achieve our desired outcomes? Now, you can do that in, say, estimation and costing, and then you don't need to use BIM software engineering economics, you use your systems approach. You can do that in your software development lifecycle, and then you don't need agile processes or Scrum, you use your systems development approach. It's an approach that says there is no theory, so let's rely primarily on observation and on empirical changes to those observations based on hypothesized changes. Then the second contribution of SEMAT is to say, given that there is no underlying theory of software engineering, no theoretical underpinning, let's try and create one, but let's base it on what we observed by doing all of those tweaks, by having that systems thinking. Let's build the explaining theory of that system. So that is another factor saying that there's that the ideas don't go out of date that often. There's actually nothing there to go out of date. We just have this sort of partly scientific and partly folkloric idea of what we do and of what works, and sometimes those things are compatible and sometimes they conflict. So as I said, like, particular tools come and go way faster than ideas. I used particularly the example of web technologies. But, you know, if you think, well, there are big ideas embodied in recent changes like Kubernetes. Kubernetes has taken a long time to develop to the point where it is now. So it's, you know, whether or not it's a new idea depends really on probably how old you are and whether you entered the software engineering ecosystem before Kubernetes was a thing. But it is basically used for virtualization and hardware abstraction. Now, that's been around for many decades. IBM's mainframes had a virtualization system such that without having a time-sharing operating system, multiple people could all run their software on top of one physical piece of hardware. You could look at like Solaris zones, FreeBSD jails, other virtualization technologies like hypervisors and so on. All of these things embody the same idea, giving what looks like a computer but is actually a like time sliced and resource limited chunk of a real computer to people to use as if it were a whole computer. Well, DevOps is new then. Yeah, that was definitely a thing that had its moment with the Accelerate book and the Phoenix Project and so on. Well, yes, but DevOps is like kind of agile told again, right? It's, you know, saying that the people who are working on the software, whether they are writing the software or using the software or like running the software for other people, should all have shared goals and should self-organize on achieving those goals. It's the same idea. Equivalently, it's the theory of constraints for software managers. You know, the Phoenix Project book is like such a light retelling of Goldratt's The Goal that they even have a character reading Goldratt's The Goal inside the Phoenix Project. It's, you know, it's that blatant. These are old ideas retold, and the reasons they're retold are interesting, and that might be part of this monograph, that might be part of the art of software engineering. Why do we have to continually rediscover functional programming, object-oriented programming, theory of constraints, agile, DevOps, virtualization? Why are these things new every time that they are encountered? And then there's the things that were actually invented a long time ago and are only becoming usable tools now because of the computational constraints, i.e. the physical capabilities of the computer that are required, being available now and not having been available at time of creation. Machine learning, neural networks, both like decades old and just weren't applicable using contemporary computers of the 70s and the 80s. Now they are applicable, and there's like, you know, much more interest in machine learning research or AI research, but there's little in the way of theoretical development in terms of the things that lead to like product innovations and in terms of things that lead to new developments and applications. I'm not saying that there isn't development in theoretical AI. There is a lot of development in theoretical AI, but that is not what is leading to the applications. The applications are, we took this off-the-shelf library, set up an architecture and trained it against our data, and we got this accuracy, and then we changed the architecture, you know, we added some hyperparameters, and we got this accuracy, and this one is better than that one, so that's how you solve this problem, QED. That is application of 1970s research to the development of new products. It is not new ideas. Similarly, faddish type systems, you know, the idea that like you can use Haskell in production now is just because you can now wait for a Haskell compiler to compile in reasonable time. I mean, you could almost make the same argument for C++ that is only very recently, despite the wide success of its application, has only recently become reasonable to compile significant C++ template code in reasonable time. So yes, I think that one person could probably write the multi-volume Art of Software Engineering, What We Know and Believe About Making Software. I think they could probably do it for a broad audience using the ideas, the principles, rather than the tools. You know, so even using the practices, you know, talking about how we do unit testing, but not about whether we write S-unit style tests or Gherkin style tests. They could probably write that multi-volume book within one lifetime. And the interesting thing about that is that if we assume that software started around 1950, because it took like a few years for computers to escape the military or military intelligence applications that they had and become both commercial and academic like pieces of equipment. So if we assume that software started in 1950, then we are now 71 years into the history of software. So in 29 years' time, we'll be at the centenary of software engineering. And I think it probably is possible to write The Art of Software Engineering before then, before 2050, and to actually have a book that sums up what we know about software engineering to date and that stays up to date with advances in the ideas, not in the tools, in the practices and the principles, not the like individual applications and the fads. If you achieve it, please do let me know. You can email grahamlee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter. I was Lee G. Thank you very much. Good luck with writing that book. You'll probably make quite a lot of money off it, but it is like going to be a deferred income. It will take you a long time to realise that revenue. But as I say, good luck, and I will talk to you again next time.